The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So one of the notions of Buddhism is the idea of a path. There's a path of practice, a path that leads to liberation. And one of the interesting issues is how that path unfolds for people. How do we make progress along the path? And the way that it's talked about in the earliest Buddhist tradition is different than how most people, I think about making progress, where we're the cause and we're doing something so that there can be progress that we make happen, taking responsibility for it. And in the early tradition, the way that the path is described, or the way that it unfolds along the path, is it unfolds, our job is to create the conditions for the unfolding of a path. We don't make the path, we don't make progress, we create the conditions so progress can happen. So that's what I want to talk about today. And and I'd like to, one of the things you're going to hear, I think, frequently, is a sequence of five different mental factors. And I want to just highlight that so you'll listen to them. Maybe you'll learn them by the end of the day. You don't have to, but... So those five are gladness, joy, tranquility, happiness, and concentration. So gladness, joy, tranquility, happiness, and concentration. So the Buddha used an analogy of a farmer. A farmer doesn't is not the cause for the plants to grow, but the farmer creates the conditions so the plant can grow. You go out and see a plant that's growing in the field, the farmer doesn't start tugging on the corn plant to make it longer. You know, pull it out and pull from the roots and the top and just like stretch it and then put it back in or something. The growing is not the farmer's, doesn't cause it, but the farmer has a very important role of creating the conditions, the right conditions, supportive conditions, so the plant can grow. And so the Buddha used that analogy to talk about people's development, unfolding, cultivation of the path, the practice. That we're cultivating it, the path, cultivating the qualities of practice by putting together conditions that support the growth of something. And this analogy of a growing plant is using an image from nature of a natural unfolding as opposed to a human-made unfolding, that we make something, you know, we make something, do something like that. And so we see this repeatedly, that the Buddha seems to have related to the idea of the growth of spiritual growth as a natural unfolding, a natural growth that maybe is inherent in who we are. It's kind of built into our whole system that given the right conditions, we will grow on a path of liberation. And I like to think of this as being a very positive view of our life and humankind, that almost as if there's kind of in the system we have this possibility for growth towards liberation. And later in Buddhism, they came up with this idea that there was inherent in us a Buddha nature. Somehow there was some potential within us that a seed, sometimes called it a seed, that could sprout, and it was just sitting there waiting for us to let it sprout. And then it would grow into this great plant and eventually flower. He used a different analogy, also kind of from nature, for how the path unfolds, and that is rainwater coming down, raining on a mountain. And if it's a lot of rain, then the rainwater comes in the mountain, it starts flowing downhill, and then it forms little streamlets, then little streams, comes together and forms creeks, comes together and makes rivers, and eventually comes and flows into the great ocean. And if there's no obstruction, to the water going downhill, the water will flow downhill. It's the nature of water on a hill, is it'll flow downhill because of gravity. And but you can obstruct it. You can put up a dam or put something in the way and the water might get stopped. So the Buddha talked about the same and used that analogy to describe the unfolding of practice. That practice also has a beginning, maybe the rain, and then with that, once you're kind of the rain has begun, things will start rolling downhill. And that our job is to just get out of the way, make sure there's no obstructions for it, to let this unfold and go. And this is a very different image than the idea that spiritual practice is climbing the mountain to the mountaintop. Sometimes you have that image, you know, that all roads lead to the top, all spiritual roads lead to the same mountain peak or something. It's always, you know, uphill. And I don't know of anywhere where the Buddha used the idea of a mountain, that the path goes up a mountain to the top. He used much more the idea of water flowing. And water always flows downhill, kind of naturally follows the flow of gravity. And in fact, someone who's really well established in the path of practice is called a stream enterer, someone who's entered the stream. And once you're in the stream, the current carries you along. And so rather than an image of hard work, huffing and puffing up a mountain, the image is one of ease, of just flowing, of kind of just going along downhill. For a lot of people, the path is not that easy, but that's because there's big rocks in the way. And so you have to deal with the obstructions. But if we can just get out of the way, then something's going to unfold. And one of the things that sometimes gets in the way is we try too much, try too hard. We take too much responsibility, and we're measuring ourselves, and how am I doing, and I have to work harder. Sometimes the very effort to work harder just doesn't, it's not trusting this unfolding that can happen. So one of the ways he talked about this unfolding, flowing down river, is through these five sets of things I discussed. That you put together certain condition has to be there, and then from that arises gladness. And I don't think we use the word glad that often in English anymore. When's the last time any of you used the word glad, that you were glad? You used it recently? Good. Good, you're old-fashioned. And I don't hear it that much to me. I don't use it, but except in this Buddhist context of gladness, And then joy, tranquility, happiness, and concentration. So what are some of the conditions that that sequence begins by? It begins, in one place the Buddha talks about having confirmed confidence in the Dharma, confidence in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. And confirmed confidence arises in this particular teaching from having known that you have obstructions in your mind. You have kind of funny ways in which your mind works with greed or hate or fear or things like that, kind of things you're caught up and attached with. To know it's there and then to let go of it and to know that it's disappeared, at least temporarily. And to know the absence of those fear, the attachments, the clinging, the selfishness that might be there, to see the absence in your own mind. That, to see that, to know that, gives a person confirmed confidence in the Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha. If you really want to know what the Buddha is about, you have to look in your own mind. And you know it in your own mind when your mind is not attached, caught by something. And the idea here is when you can see that for yourself, that you have a mind that at least temporarily is free from what you are caught in, that that confirms what the Buddha was pointing at. And knowing that is a possibility, knowing that you can realize this for yourself, the Buddha is expecting that that's going to bring us gladness. Or some certain kind of delight, certain appreciation, some kind of inspiration. And that if we relax into that gladness, allow for it to be there, then the Buddha says that gladness gives born to joy. And with joy comes tranquility. And with tranquility there arises happiness. And with happiness the mind gets concentrated. And all these ways of talking about it are all passive verbs in the original language, meaning it's not a person who's doing this. It's not like, okay, now that you let go of all these attachments, now get busy and be glad. You know, okay, now you're glad, check off that, now you got to work hard and get joyful. And if you're joyful, then get tranquil. And that's something you do, but it's more something we allow. The water is flowing down the river. And so you have to allow yourself to allow these states to come up and to be appreciate, to have gladness, to be there. And so there are a number of places in the suttas the Buddha talks about this sequence and different conditions that give birth to this gladness, and then so these things can follow. One of the common ones is no longer having hindrances. The very famous list of five hindrances. And these are considered in the ancient text, often the beginning of meditation practice is settling the five hindrances. Five hindrances are greed, aversion, sloth and torpor, restlessness and anxiety or regret, and doubt. And these are powerful forces of the mind that keep us preoccupied, keep us spinning out, thinking, worrying, planning, all these things. And so the mind can't settle. And one of the great pleasures of meditation is to feel the hindrances, these preoccupations of the mind, abate. And then you're a little bit more in control of your own mind then. Because when the hindrances are there, you're not in control, because you're getting pulled into desire, pulled into aversive thoughts, pulled into fantasy, and pulled into doubt. And you can let go of it and just get pulled back in. And sometimes they take a big control over us, and we act because of it. They kind of become filters in which we see the world and filters through which we try to accomplish things in the world. And so to actually feel the freedom, this lightens up, and we're no longer under control of the hindrances. It's just a relief. And the Buddha talked repeatedly about how there's gladness that comes when we're no longer caught in the grip of the hindrances. And so to avail ourselves of that gladness, to allow for it. If you don't know that that's a good thing to do, then you might not take the time to appreciate it. Some people are task-oriented, and so, you know, they realize that they have to maybe let go of their strong aversion so they can settle down, and so they manage to do that. But then, once you do that, well, then you have to get on to the next task. The next task, well, now you're supposed to be, you know, do this and that. And so they don't take the time to do nothing and just enjoy and appreciate what's there. So the gladness that's there. So the Buddha listed a number of different things that create this sequence. And sometimes he talked about the consequences of... And sometimes he talked about a bit bigger set, the longer list of conditions that unfold. And these are all conditions. They're not actions so much. So one of them is virtue. And beautiful, I think... teaching, maybe it's a little challenging, but the Buddha said, if a person is virtuous, then it's natural that they would be free of remorse. Even if they have no intention to be free of remorse. So you don't have the intention to be free of remorse if you are virtuous. And then he said, if a person is virtuous, if the person is free of remorse, then naturally they'll be more attentive. Maybe because they're not preoccupied with remorse, so they're more present. If they are more attentive, then naturally they'd practice mindfulness. They'd just be mindful or practice mindfulness. If they're mindful, then naturally they would restrain themselves from acting on their greed and hate and things like that. Just as natural that you do that if you see clearly. It's kind of like if you finally, if you finally pull a thorn that's out of your foot, you don't go back and walk on the rose bushes again. you restrain yourself from that. If you have enough mindfulness to know what you're doing, you don't step there again to put more thorns in. And then if you restrain yourselves carefully this way, then naturally you would abandon the hindrances. If you do that, then naturally you'd get concentrated. If you do that, naturally you would develop what's called the seven factors of awakening, certain seven mental states that arise. If these states arise, seven factors of awakening, then naturally you would see things as they are and become liberated. So here we have the sequence again, this idea of conditions. We put together certain conditions, and that allows something to begin unfolding. And so here, this sequence begins with virtue. And over again in Buddhism, the idea of creating virtue, being virtuous, is not a moralistic thing, that you're supposed to be moralistically have virtue, but rather you want to create the very best conditions in place so a natural process in your heart can begin to unfold. And virtue is one of them. Certain kind of freedom or ease or something. And then the water begins to flow downriver. I think for many of us, maybe this can seem like a very foreign idea, that we can trust something so deeply inside of ourselves that it's not our doing. We're not responsible for it. But we are responsible for putting together the conditions. And if you study carefully what the Buddha taught, you see that he didn't actually tell us to do very much. One of the primary things he said is pay attention. Know what's going on. And there's something about knowing that maybe gives breathing room for things to unfold. Something about knowing that removes obstruction so things can flow downhill. And then he used words like restraint of the senses or let go of certain things. And these are mostly ways of taking the obstacles away from the water flowing. So restraint of the senses, safeguarding yourself of the senses means be careful so you don't put up barriers to the flowing water. Because there's this beautiful thing that goes on. So rather than some kind of puritanical idea, restraint of the senses, get all tight and uptight and just kind of don't avoid anything that's, you know, nice. it's more like there's this great thing going on here. Relax, open up, but then be careful that you don't do something that obstructs this beautiful heart that you have, this beautiful unfolding that can happen. Be careful that if you see something, be scared. You know, if you go driving down the freeway here in 101, and you're really tempted by advertisements and billboards. And that last three times you went down the freeway and you saw a billboard for some electronic device, you stepped on the gas, 90 miles an hour, zipped in and out, rushed into the parking lot of the electronics store, ran in, bought the device, and didn't notice anybody else in the road or anybody else that you ran over or anything else. And you bought the device without even remembering that you have no money in your bank account anymore and credit cards in debt. And then when you got home, you finally look at it and say, what do I need this for? So for that, during that time, that obsessive thinking, that was the obstacle to allowing some kind of deeper unfolding to happen. And so if that's your pattern, how you drive down 101, maybe don't go 101. Don't go on the freeway, or don't look at the billboards. Be careful with yourself until you can, such a day that you're strong enough mind that you can go down there, look at billboards, and just wave at them and say, well, they chose kind of a good color pattern this time in the design, and not get pulled into the, you know. So it seems to me that a lot of the practice the Buddha has taught is about getting out of the way and allowing something to, this process to unfold and flow. And even practices like concentration, entering into the jhanas, the deep concentrated states, it's not clear exactly how the way it's worded. It says one enters and abides in a deep, concentrated state. But it's not exactly clear if entering is something that you choose to do or entering is something that just naturally arises. And it's maybe a little bit of a combination of both. It's more like maybe we direct the mind, but then there's the momentum of our conditioning, the good conditions we put in place, tips us into a concentrated state. And I know this is, for the most part, my experience, is that when I get concentrated, which sometimes is a great delight to get really concentrated, it's one of the pleasures of life, but for the most part, I never feel responsible for getting concentrated. All I know what to do is I put the conditions in place, and then at some point, and I don't know when it's going to be, I get concentrated. And I just sit there and do my job and put the conditions in place and be present. And then at some point, I'm just letting things, I trust the whole process. At some point, I get concentrated. And then also the whole experience of liberation, you know, Buddha is to really be completely free of our clingings and our holdings and our grasping, to really set this heart, you know, unshackle the heart, is often presented in this early tradition as something you can't do, but something you put the conditions in place for. And when the Buddha discussed his own liberation, when he talked about it, described it, he said, he doesn't say anything about how he got liberated. The cause of liberation is not described. He talks about the conditions he had to put in place, and one of those was to have a concentrated, clear mind. And then all it says is that he directed his mind to know. Here we see the example where knowing is important. He directed his mind to know, to paraphrase, to know the end of his attachments. That his attachments have come to an end. And so there's a gap. Like, well, how did that happen? You know, how did he end those attachments? What did he do? Did he push the button? You know, there's a little red button in the heart. Just push that button, and it ejects it. You know, how does that happen? I think that because he doesn't say, because liberation is, you have to put the conditions in, and then something happens. Something lets go. And so kind of an analogy I like to use for this, some of you have done this with me before, is if you make a really tight fist with your hand, and you're welcome to do it, and the idea is to make, do it really tight. I mean, so you're doing it, then just keep your hand really tight while I'm talking, okay? I'll tell you not to do it. But you have to make it really tight, so you really get white on your knuckles, really tight, you know? Just keep it that way, okay? So then, keep it that way, okay? In India, the way that people catch monkeys is they take a coconut, keep it tight, and they would do a horizontal slit in the coconut, and then they put a candy inside, and they tie the coconut to a tree. And the monkeys, who are supposed to be kind of, you know, like sweets, they come along and they put their hands in flat through that little horizontal slot, keeping your fist tight. And then you put your hand all the way in, and you grab the candy, but then you have kind of a fist, right? And then the fist doesn't go out. And because they're so greedy, apparently, these monkeys, they're not going to let go of the candy, and so the farmer, the hunter, just comes along and picks them up. So now you can let go of your tight fist. So the chances are, unless you really locked in and froze because it was so long, the natural tendency was to want for the fist by itself to want to release itself, to relax. But you had to keep being reminded and keep putting, you know, oh, got to do it, do it. And this very, you know, fascinating story about the monkey, you know, is distracting you. So you had to kind of remind yourself, I have to keep it tight. Is that right? Yeah. So the natural tendency of the fist, of that kind of grasping, is to be released, is to relax, is to open up. And so what we're being liberated from Buddhism is the ways in which the heart or the mind clings or grasps or is tight. And there's a natural tendency for that to want to relax, to let go. And you can sometimes, and I think it's part of the longing or desire for freedom that people have, comes from an intuitive sense that it is possible to not do this thing called grasping or clinging. It is possible to get to the other side of that, of having the fist open. Then there's no more fist, right? Just a hand, an open hand. So the same thing with the heart. The heart can open. The mind can open, can release. And so because it's not, but that releasing of the fist is, it's kind of like the nature of the fist to want to relax and open. And even if you don't want the fist to open, by the fist by itself will relax. You have to keep inserting your effort. So I call this the biological imperative to relax. The biological imperative for liberation. I think it's built into our whole system to want to be free. In this kind of simple, kind of almost biological way, that we want to be free. And that's why this idea of getting out of the way is so important, because there is something within us that it's operating that wants to go in that direction. And it doesn't have to be that mysterious, some mysterious kind of inner working that's very complicated. It's maybe almost as simple as you know, that when we're holding tight, there's a natural tendency to want to relax and let go. As we begin to relax and let go in small degrees, it begins to release not just the fist open up, but other qualities come as well. So when I release, open up the fist, then the blood flows nicely. I feel the coolness of my palm. I feel you know softer in my fingers, and a variety of nice things come. So the same thing as the conditions as we release the heart in this kind of process, then it comes with the opening of other things awaken up, get awoken. And so there's gladness, joy, tranquility, happiness, and concentration. And then the Buddha said, when one is concentrated, he said, for someone who's concentrated, one who is concentrated will see things as they are. It doesn't say, get concentrated, now get busy and do the seeing. It says, if you're concentrated, you will begin seeing things as they are. There's something about the settled, quiet, clear, steady, stable mind that allows us to begin seeing much more clearly what's here. And as we see what's here more clearly, then this is a condition to help support the release, the freedom. It's kind of like knowing, awareness, seeing things clearly, creates lots of room in which, lots of space, lots of clear space in which the water can flow or the plant can grow. So I don't know if you prefer being water or prefer being a plant. But either analogies is used to describe the natural unfolding of this practice based on the existence of certain conditions, dependent on conditions. So that's the point I want to make today. So now we have some minutes here. If any of you have any questions or comments about this you'd like to make, or testimonials about the natural unfolding?
Could you please briefly put into context the difference between gladness, joy, and happiness? Because they're clearly delineated. I think they're sort of synonyms culturally.
Yes. So... this is how I understand it, that gladness is evaluative. There's an evaluation conceptually, oh, this is really great. I'm no longer caught in the hindrances. So it's a little more evaluative. It's comparative. It's recognizing something. If we relax further into that gladness, then there can come a joy that is not evaluative. It's not based or dependent on what's happening in the world. So there's kind of a deep, it's kind of a process of getting concentrated or settled or unified. So as we settle more and more deeply, then there's a wells up. And the example the Buddha used for this is, again, and from the nature, is a lake where there's no river, no rain that fills it with water, but there's an underground spring that fills it. And that underground spring, water wells up and flows up into the water. So at some point, there's the release of some kind of energy inside of us that that is joy that doesn't depend on winning the lottery. It doesn't depend on anything in the world. It's kind of like the nature of this release, this freedom. Like, so when I hold my fist tight and relax my fist, I feel this kind of, I wouldn't call it joy exactly, but it's nice energy and flow. And it's not really dependent on the fact that something great happened in the world. It happened because there's a nature of the blood flowing freely that it feels really nice. So the joy is not, gladness is evaluative. The joy is not. It's more of an upwelling of something. And but it's in the tradition. Sometimes they translate this word as thrill, because it's a kind of has a mental quality to it. This kind of joy, there's a mental excitement or inspiration or enthusiasm at this particular level of practice. As the mind gets more settled, as things relax more, on a steep mountainside, the river goes fast. Once it gets really big river and gets down to the plains, it goes much more quieter and smoother. It doesn't make so much noise as it's going down over the rocks and the rapids. So remember, you have to go through tranquility. There's joy, tranquility, and happiness. As we get more tranquil, then the mental thrill or the enthusiasm of the joy quiets down. And it's replaced with the word is sukha. Some translators translate it as pleasure, but that gives them the wrong idea. But it's more physical, it's deeper, more sublime, it's quieter. It's kind of like a quiet, suffusing sense of well-being that doesn't have any thrill or excitement to it in the way that joy does. And it's more satisfying. Does that make sense? Does that make a distinction for you?
Yes, thank you.
The Buddhist tradition has lots of names and distinctions about all kinds of different joys and happinesses. And because it's such a big part of the tradition, they kind of, differentiate lots more than what I talked about now. Yes?
I have an example, so a bit of a testimonial, and also a point about this. It was Paul's birthday yesterday, so we took a very long hike, a 15-mile hike. And during it, there were some really difficult uphill parts. I mean, most of the time, it's like a very, very, very long meditation. So most of the time, I was feeling pretty good and happy and virtuous, and it was enjoyable. But there were some very, very steep parts. And at one point, I got in touch with a lot of anger. Like, how could he do this? This is terrible. I'm not enjoying this at all. And then I kind of let go of the anger because it was really getting in my way. And I just said, I'm just going to do it. I'm just going to climb and put one foot in front of the other, and eventually it'll level out again. So it did, and then I, about half hour later, I was achieved a more equanimous state, and it was much calmer. But I think the important point is that when those other difficult emotions come up, if I could just let it go, let go of the anger, then it just made space again.
Mm-hmm. For it, right. Often these so-called negative emotions don't make much space for something deeper and more important, wisdom to operate. Mm-hmm. And so rather than letting go of them because we're trying to get rid of something bad, and it's more like we're letting them go so we can make room for something great, that's more useful to operate.
Yeah, and I did it the way, just kind of being mindful about that I was feeling that and where it was in my body, and then it kind of let go. So.
Great, and I bet the people you were with also benefited from that.
They did.
So up here, if you could... It's a green light.
There we go. I don't know if this is a question or comment or whatnot, but it's just interesting. I really like the topic of conditioning. You know, that's really, I'm really feeling that, and that's been my experience, is allowing things to flow, you know. And I just couldn't help but kind of getting this ping on growing up in this world and having, for myself, been through different stages of life, now noticing how the world has been conditioning me, you know. And so going through these different stages and making changes for myself with, you know, diet and the people I'm around and this and that. And now, you know, everything that's happened in these past 39 years for me to be sitting right here in this space around these people, this Sangha, for the optimal conditions for myself to grow and unfold. So just that recognition of this world of experiential stuff that we go through and all the different things vying for our attention and stuff that condition us, and somehow I've made the choices to be here today. And it's so beautiful that I'm sitting here. I started listening to your podcast years ago, and then all of a sudden, just this past week, I was like, I'm in the Bay Area now, and I just, I'm like, this place is here. And so I'm very glad. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. It's very nice to hear. And welcome. This is your first time here. Welcome. Nice to have you. And so kind of to kind of build on what you said a little bit. So there are all these conditions, right? And some are, you know, unhealthy conditions that happen. Some are healthy conditions, just you stumble upon them, and they're good conditions that support us. And then there's those, and then there's the ability to choose the conditions. And then, and so have you found that as you're kind of going along here, that you're becoming, choosing better, making better choices for the conditions that support you. And from that, there's faster growth of your plant. Great, thank you. Someone else?
You were speaking at the beginning about creating the conditions, and then also mentioned that we have to let go of the obstructions of the mind. What do you do? I wondered if you could talk a little bit about the kind of obstructions that come up on a kind of, what's the word? They come up continually, that sort of have a pattern of coming up, and every time you kind of trip over the same thing.
Yeah.
The same kind of behavior, the same kind of way of thinking, the same kind of situation that you get yourself into, and you don't know how you found yourself there.
Right.
So I was wondering if you could just talk about, because I was very intrigued by this idea of creating the conditions and then allowing what needs to emerge to emerge. But what do you do about those specific type of obstructions? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. It's a great question. And as you were talking, a whole bunch of ideas came to my mind, because it all depends on some of the details of what in particular you're talking about, specifically what kind of advice someone like you might receive. But I'll start with one, that's the one that came to the top of my mind as you spoke. And that has to do with a story of the Sufi wise person named Mulla Nasruddin, who was growing up a garden. And there were weeds that kept growing in the garden. And so he tried to get rid of these weeds, but he couldn't get rid of them. And so he went to some of the best gardeners in the city, and they all gave lots of advice, and nothing worked to get these weeds. And so then he went to the best gardeners in the country, and nothing worked. Finally, he was told there's one master gardener high up in the mountain somewhere, I don't know, and that person knows what to do. So he made his trek up there. What do I do with these weeds? And the master gardener says, heard, oh, you've done all these things. Oh, you've done all these things. Good. There's only one thing left for you to do. Love the weeds.
Thank you. Perfect answer. Thank you.
Well, so if you're satisfied with that, let's let it go.
Actually, the weeds become the teachers.
Yes. So. Uh-huh. And but one of the, in my mind, this idea of the weeds become the teacher is that that means we actually stop to look at them and study them and let them be there. And sometimes it's counterproductive to have a frontal assault on our obstructions, like they're bad and have to get rid of these. As I said earlier, a big part of this Buddhist practice is to get to know what's there really well. And if it keeps reappearing, then it might be that it means you haven't gotten to know it well enough yet.
Haven't gotten the what?
Haven't gotten to know it well enough.
Oh, okay.
So maybe there's more to look at.
Thank you. Very helpful.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Oh, so one more, then we'll stop. Here, right in front.
Hi. Okay. I was wondering if you could elaborate a bit on the idea of virtuosity, how it can exist without morality, or how the two ideas are separate.
Oh. Well, this is now we're getting into the philosophy of ethics in a way that I don't really know so well. Some of you have studied this more than I have to know the distinctions, and I'm probably using these words more at a ordinary colloquial way or simple ways, you know. And it's probably not, my use of the words is probably not so appropriate, but in certain circles in English, to be moralistic is not a good thing. It's kind of being puritanical. It's also considered not a good thing. I mean, the Puritans probably feel maligned, but they're not here to complain. So to be excessively moralistic is to be rule-based. And to be clinging to rules only, as if there's a rule that thou shalt be this way, you're supposed to be this way, and this is how you have to be. And that can cause a tremendous amount of suffering in the world when we apply these rules to other people. So rules about sexual behavior, for example, it's tremendous damage to people. People have died because of people's rules of what's right and wrong. So this idea of strict rules-based, I think of being moralistic. And so in that sense, Buddhism is not moralistic in terms of following strict rules so much, except don't kill anyone. That's a good rule. But there's another basis for ethics in Buddhism is this. Buddhism has many rationales for being ethical. But what I was pointing out today is one of the reasons to be ethical is to create the conditions for our own spiritual well-being. It also creates the conditions for the well-being of our society, which is also another motivating factor. So it's not rule-based. It's not like, I'm going to have to do this because Buddhism tells me. It's more like, I'm going to do this because it's better for me and everyone else. Does that distinction make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, so... I hope that you put together good conditions, and one of the conditions is to give yourself time for a natural unfolding to happen. If you are busy all the time, then I think this deep path of liberation doesn't have much chance to surface. It needs time for something, the heart, to kind of unfold. And I hope that this talk inspires you that, at least from the perspective of Buddhism, you have a great heart. It's a real treasure. And now let's set it free. Thank you.